the longer you've been a Catholic, the more you could almost put money on it what this sermon's going to be about, right? You doubting Thomases. It's part of our idiomatic language. This poor guy is known down through the ages as the weak one who didn't believe, though the others did. But I think there's a whole other way to look at this. And there's not always welcome, but a very powerful message and challenge here. Note the last words of the gospel passage. These things were recorded so that you would believe, and you'd believe without having been there yourself to see and touch it all in that once only historical event. Let's think about it. It's so simple, really, if you just say, well, see, the point is, Jesus had risen, Thomas didn't believe it unless it was just proven to him like a scientific fact, and we've all got to try to get above our technology and scientific approach and just believe on faith, and the homily rolls its way to its obvious conclusion. But what if? What if this moment with Thomas is meant to say something else? What if Thomas is, you might say, after Jesus, the hero in this story? After all, these same disciples, apostles, gathered in this room, who had come what we might call the Lenten journey of the missionary route of Jesus, those 3 years of teaching and preaching, didn't all of them, Thomas included, get scolded time and time again for wanting to get the grand conclusion without going the rocky road on the way to it? Didn't he say, as he came to Jerusalem to meet his destiny, don't you guys understand? Don't you understand yet from all the Old Testament scriptures, from all I've been saying to you, and from what you see happening to me, don't you understand a Messiah can only be a Messiah after he's been made a mess? There will not be a risen, glorified Lord until there is a Lord put down, defeated, and trampled upon. He even got so specific as to say, listen, it is necessary for the Messiah first to suffer and even then to die before he can get up in glory. Maybe Thomas was remembering all of that. Think of what he said in this way. He says to the apostles, you tell me this glowing vision was here the other night and I missed out on it. Jesus is Lord, is Messiah. I'll believe it when I see the wounds by which he earned his messiahship. Emblems now, like priceless decorations, if you will, but wounds nonetheless earned in the struggle of the battle and the losing. Thomas says, let me test this vision of Lord and Messiah. I want to see the proof that he was wounded. Let me put his hand in his side, which had to be opened by violence in order to be the gateway to salvation for the whole world. Oh, what a different conclusion you get then. Now, Jesus does say, Thomas, now you believe it. It's all been put together. Blessed are and will they be who will believe without having to see every detail historically worked out. But Thomas is brought stage center so that we may all remember that he who is Lord forever and ever had first to be the failure of failures. And why did it happen? Because he went down there and got himself involved in the human struggle. He hung around with prostitutes and sinners. He sat down to table with the unwashed and the utterly unpopular. He got himself so close to our frail and foolish flesh that it infuriated the nice people. They would have loved to have a magic man in their midst. But the more Jesus showed the kind of people he wanted to be with and for whom he came, the less tolerable was his very presence, indeed, even his breathing, to those who like to keep things nice and neat. With the foreordained in charge and the foreordained taking orders and just doing as they're told. Jesus came to upset the whole order of things, and wounded he was and defeated utterly until he got up again by the divine power to set everything straight. The story of Thomas is a good story on which to meditate if you live in a world and in a culture where people find every evidence of human frailty and failing disturbing and abhorrent, and try to gloss over all the pains and hurts of the human condition. We live in a culture that virtually deifies athletes, performers and entertainers, even, in spite of ourselves, politicians. Some of you, I know, are old enough to remember what a devastating thing it was for us when one of our created heroines, Ingrid Bergman, turned out to be a sinner, a fleshy person like the rest of us. That was such a shock in its day. Our facade had been so carefully constructed and maintained. We, in a manner of speaking, threw her out of the country. How dare she make us deal with a hero, successful, rich, popular, beautiful, all of a sudden as likely to sin and make a fool of herself as the rest of us. That was what's unforgivable for our culture. Some of us exulted in the days of John Kennedy. All he had to do was say Camelot, and we were practically transported there. We wanted to live in a magic land of great heroes, untouched by the human condition. And even though subsequent history has demonstrated rather effectively that John Kennedy was one of us indeed, with all our weaknesses as well as some of our best strengths, we're in the process of recanonizing him anyway. It was interesting, President Bush mentioned it the other day. We have a great knack for wiping away all the things we'd rather not face, and we give a certain glow of glory to all our past presidents. It only takes time. But we're doing it to ourselves day in and day out. We let people who earn fortunes entertaining us become our heroes. And we prefer not to realize that, as the working man's phrase would put it, they put their pants on one leg at a time like the rest of us. We are subjects of a massive campaign of pretense that life can be glorious without the hurting, that we can all be beautiful and stay that way forever. But Thomas, in a sense, speaks for us all and says, give me a glorified Messiah, yes, but I want to touch his wounds. I want to feel the flesh that has been hurt and rent by human sin, human cruelty, and that's the Lord in whom I can believe. He touched the wounds. He reached into the wounded side of Jesus and then was able to say, this is my Lord and my God. In practical terms, my sisters and brothers, God understands how we try to make everything Camelot. He understands all that. He understands, if you will, our passion to beautify and dwell on lovely exteriors. But he will not resist calling us forever to become entangled in the hurt, in the unhappiness, and the despair of the poorest of the poor, the loneliest of the lonely. And he'd have us know that is how we will find the risen Christ alive and real in the world today. There is an insert in today's bulletin prepared very carefully and lovingly by a member of our Social Justice Committee, Matt McCurran, to try to help share with others a practical understanding of the issue that is now before the Congress on the minimum wage. There'll be people over at Father Ray Hall after this Mass hoping you'll at least take the time, come and at least sign your name to some petition to the government to see that we finally come to grips with this issue and raise the minimum wage for the little people. And some of us, I do believe, at least I strongly suspect, some of us have yet to be persuaded on that rather simple, starkly simple issue. We have been so conditioned to believe that somehow there was God's will for some of us to be rich and powerful and the rest of us to be grateful that they let us continue to exist. If Jesus is alive and present today, you can be much more sure he's there in the marketplace where people are struggling for the bare essentials of life. More likely to be there, not only, but more likely than in the corporate boardrooms where they're trading not just airplanes, but entire airlines. Playing with paper so that the rich people can become richer still. Jesus is present in us all, but most of all, and most challengingly, in those of us who are hurting and the most helpless. It would have been nice to just sing another Alleluia song, say uplifting, happy, joyful, giddy things today to celebrate Easter. But the gospel does not permit of that. Over and over again, Jesus makes us look for him in his glory through the wounds and the hurts of his people. He's unrelenting in that way. We might say, you tell me the Lord is present today. Don't try to prove it to me by saying, well, look, this fellow has massive wealth, tremendous power, incredible popularity, the adulation of the people. A warning sign has already been given me in the gospel. I say, he may well be there in a certain sense. He certainly is. But I will more safely search for him and more securely lay hold of him if I look for him in the people who feel the agony and the pain of the search for basic human dignity and simple human needs. Thomas says, my Lord and my God, when he sees that the Messiah is the wounded one. The church invites us to look to the wounded, to look to those who are scarred by human frailty and incapacity, the victims of human injustice and selfishness and greed, to look there and be most certain to find him. If we make that search, if we involve ourselves in the problems of the poor, if we allow ourselves to be touched by the blood of the wounded of our society and our world, then in the way that Thomas did, we will be given a vision in which we can say, through wounds and glory all mixed together, my Lord and my God. And that Lord, that God will breathe on us and say, hear this. If you will mend the broken, it will be mended. If you will forgive the sins, they will be forgiven. If you hold back, they will be held back. Peace be with you. We say to this Lord, as much as we can, haltingly still, but as best we can this morning, to this wounded Lord made glorious, to him we say, my Lord and my God. and it's he who answers out of the hurts and the cries of the poor and says, "Peace be with you."